It's time for building the game.
Building the game
with Jason and friends from Tabletop Game Design. The fun never ends. It's at the end of the episode. That's
when it technically ends.
Hello and welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. Today is Monday, May 13th, and you're listening to episode 624. As always, I am your host, Jason. Here today, I have a new guest, somebody we haven't had on before, and that is Nicole Fendi, game designer, author, a.k.a. the Numbers Whisperer. She's the co-founder of Creatopia.studio and loves to help creatives succeed financially, which is something I think we could all know a bit about. So, Nicole, welcome. It's great to have you.
Well, thanks. I'm excited to be here and talk about game design and all that.
Yes, yes. No, you're one of those people that I've heard your name before, and I'm sure we've been at the same place many times, but we've only met recently over Discord. So
yes,
which I think you were directed to our Discord by Heather Newton. Is that correct?
Correct.
The number one referrer of the BTG Discord Award goes to Heather Newton, who's brought in so many people to our Discord that it's crazy. It's great. It's great. I super appreciate her sending people all over all the time.
Yeah, she's amazing, and she will do whatever. If you, she knows you have something good to offer, she will promote you.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, how are you doing today?
Pretty good. I live in Minnesota, not Michigan, although I'm from Michigan, as you know. So here it's sunny and beautiful, and there wasn't just a tornado. So
yeah, five actually.
How are you doing?
Five tornadoes within about 40 miles of our house. Two of which were in about 2 miles of our house. We were fine. Our city, the closest city to me is Portage, which I'm about 2 miles away from. I'm closer to that, but 2 miles from where the tornadoes burned through. And it was tough. I don't know. I haven't heard yet if there were casualties, but there certainly was a lot of damage. Some buildings just completely destroyed. I actually popped into our Tuesday night call last night really quick to just be like, hey, I'm not going to be there. And this is why, in case anybody's hearing about this stuff in Michigan, everybody knows approximately where I live. I don't want people to be worried. And I've been getting a lot of messages of people checking in. But no, we were very fortunate. We were fine. We spent a lot of time in the basement. And I think we were fortunate that the second tornado that hit the same town within like a mile of where the other one hit, wasn't as strong as the first one, because after the first one, they said it was all clear and people were out trying to clear things up and stuff. And then another line of storms came through and produced another tornado. So was very, very, happy that the second tornado was not that bad. I heard the first one was an EF3, which is not anything to joke around about. That's a decent sized tornado.
Yeah.
So it was a little crazy. Kids were very scared. I was more nervous than I normally am for bad weather, because you're hearing names of places and I'm like, that's right by my house. So, Yeah. But so far, everybody I know has been fine. A lot of them have had some property damage, but have all been safe and healthy. And that's what we're worried about. So,
Did you have, we have tornado warnings here in Minnesota. We can get tornadoes and occasionally have bad weather, bad enough weather. We get warnings, nothing that as close as you. Do you have trouble wrangling pets? I mean, like, I have two cats.
Right.
Trying to wrangle cats.
We just have one dog, and so it's pretty easy to get him to come downstairs with us. We have this extra large bathroom in our basement for some reason that makes no sense. It's like three times the size of what it should be, and it's just like a guest bathroom. I have no idea. Like, it's even next to a storage room that they could have made bigger. So I don't know why, but so his kennel is in there. So we just bring everybody in. I put him in his kennel, and of course, like, thinking of things like bring his leash in case like our house gets demolished and we have to like go outside afterwards, So it's not so bad wrangling the pets, because we only have one. Now, if I had cats, yes, that would be harder for sure. And wrangling kids is easy, because as soon as they hear on my phone or their phones, the sirens, you know, because that actually plays on your phone now, which is great. They're immediately like ready to go downstairs. So, yeah. But it's nerve wracking, you know, and it's crazy to be like, oh, you know, I mean, it's so, what are the chances that it hits your house, right? But like my mom lives in like a 55 and up community that's mobile homes, and her house sustained a little bit of damage. She actually came here when she heard it was coming, which was, she was already out. And so she heard it was coming. She came right here, which was good because it went through her neighborhood, did a little tiny damage to her house, but not bad. Mostly just like the skirting around the bottom of her trailer. Yeah. But the, her neighbors watched the funnel cloud go through and then overturn several homes further down the street from her. So, so yeah. And then she was on the road when the second one hit, but luckily did not go through the same area because she was stuck in traffic because all the power was out and there were trees everywhere. But she was trying to just get back to her house to see, you know, what exactly she was looking at. So yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you just never know where it's going to like hit or not hit. And that is the freakiest part, right? You know?
Right. Yeah. I've been in a hurricane when I lived in Texas, and I've been in near tornadoes, but not as close as you. And I've lived through an earthquake. It was a 6.4.
Mm.
It's pretty strong. Yeah. It was when I lived in Asia. That was freaky because it was the middle of the night and you wake up, and I was living in a condo high rise. Mm-hmm. So they have these foundations now that sway.
Sway, yeah, yeah.
But I didn't know that before this earthquake happened. So you wake up and you can feel, I'm on the 11th floor and you can feel the building going back and forth. And I'm like, oh my God, the building's going to fall over. What am I supposed to do?
Right. But no, it was doing the right thing. Yeah. No, not knowing that would be terrifying. Oh my gosh. I can't imagine that because it feels so counterintuitive to what you would expect to happen, what you would think you want to happen. But it actually does make sense when you think about it, right? That they make it so it sways. But yeah, that is not something you want to find out in the moment, right?
Yep. Well, and we had just talked. I was working at a company where most of the staff were locals, and we had just talked about, for some reason, don't go on stairwells during an earthquake. Pro tip. Those are like the worst place to go during an earthquake.
Good to know.
Because they're very weak and they're easily like the stairs are easily, I guess, snapped and then you fall and die and get buried. Yeah. And so I'm thinking, I'm on the 11th floor. I can't go on the stairs.
The elevator is not a great choice.
But no, hey, that goes without saying, I thought.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so I have not had as scary an experience from a tornado as you, but I do know what it's like to feel like I can't do anything and just kind of waiting.
Yeah, and an earthquake is just really, I mean, that's scary because, like, you know, all of the other tips you have for normal natural disasters don't work with an earthquake. So, like, you know, don't go to the basement. You know, you can try and go outside, but that can also be dangerous depending on where you are. Like, if you're in a city, being outside is really dangerous. So, yeah, yeah.
That's why I don't live in a place that's known for earthquakes. Because after I experienced that, I said, you know, this is not a life I want.
Yeah, yeah.
Give me lots of snow. That's fine.
Right, right. Well, and coming from northern Michigan, you know, you've got being in Minnesota, that's probably not too much different. Yeah. Well, so enough of the natural disasters. Tell me a bit about what you do with Creatopia.
So Creatopia was a brainchild that came up during pandemic. My friend and I, Monette Satterfield, who's also a creative and an artist, a working artist, we're saying there's no joy left. Like, you know, when everything was locked down and we were all disconnected. And we decided to start something that would bring everyday creativity back to people.
Mm-hmm.
Just for fun. Like, you know, when we talk about making games, a lot of times people make games because we want to have fun, right? We want to, it's like the whole design and purpose of a game is to bring people together and have fun, which, of course, we know during the pandemic was tough because virtual games just are never as good as in person.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was our way of inspiring that and creating a place, and it has morphed into now selling creatives products and mentoring some creatives, mm-hmm. because I like helping creative people figure out how to make money. So it's just creating more joy and creativity and letting at every level. So if you just want to, if you're like, oh, I don't feel creative, or people say I'm not creative, sure you are. You just haven't figured out exactly what to do, and giving them a space to play with that and have fun.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's excellent, because I know that especially during the pandemic, for a lot of us, creativity was just the last thing you were thinking about, right? Because everything's so uncertain, and you're just trying to make it through the day to day. And so thinking about creativity is tough. I mean, that's just not, it's not on your radar, right? But it's so important in those times that we focus on that creativity, because it does bring joy, right? It does bring that everyday joy you're talking about. And that's so important to have that. And, you know, I mean, as creatives, when we are creative, obviously, you know, the financial aspect of it is tough, right? That's one of the hardest things, yes. I think, for, you know, a lot of our brains as creatives are wired to be creative, not to be financial.
Right. I get it.
Yeah, I mean, that's, those are two different skill sets. And you know what? Hey, there are some people that have them both great, right? They've got a lot of both, and we all have varying degrees of it. But I do find the people I work with that are just pure creative, that kind of just organizational side or financial side, it can just be a mystery to us sometimes. And that's hard when that's, you know, a key aspect of it. It's one of the reasons why you see more people looking for publishers instead of self-publishing, right? Because, yep. But you know, we've come to a time where sometimes finding publishers is harder than it used to be. And self-publishing is becoming a more interesting option. I know it's a really common topic in our Discord, where several of us have been working on projects, trying to get them out there, get them, you know, published on our own, whether it's via crowdfunding or direct print or, you know, whatever. It's just, it's a new option. I mean, it's not a new option, but it's a newer option that everybody's interested in now, right? That are a lot more people
right,
are.
Right.
But there's a lot of aspects to it, that make it difficult.
Well, to that point, part of what we are now moving forward with Creatopia is enabling, we're looking at new ways to help creatives be successful. So we have a membership program, we call them the Creative Champions. And if you're in, you pay just $10 a month, which is then store credits. You can buy stuff in our store. And we're taking that known revenue and using it to mentor and partner with creative emerging professionals, mm-hmm. creative professionals. And another thing, having come out of like the publishing world and done that, there's a lot of like hybrid options that you see in the book publishing world that I'd like to see us bring into the game publishing world. So it's not an all or nothing, because right mm-hmm. now game publishers can either do it all themselves and pay all the money, whether they're paying consultant, they're paying a lot, right?
Right. Yeah.
Or they have to go with a full-fledged publisher. I firmly believe there's something in the middle. And that's what we're looking to move forward with, that it's a win-win. It's everyone takes risk. And the publisher doesn't make money unless the game designer makes money.
Right, right. And that is, yeah. That is a, there are people with a lot of opinions on that.
I know.
Right? Yep. That is a tough, you know, and I think that, you know, publishers from their perspective, it all comes down to risk, right? Like, how much do they risk for the profit, and how much does the designer risk? I think we don't always think about what all that risk entails, right? I think publishers see designers, not all, I want to be clear, I'm not saying, but I think it's common for publishers to see risk as solely financial, right? But risk is time too. Like, how much time do you put into a game that then,
yes.
you know, you put all this time in, it's published, and then you make nothing off it. And the publisher might make a little something, or they might lose a little something. But in the end, it's tough when you don't consider all that time you put in, because, well, it's part of being creative is you put the time in, right? Which is true. But that time is time that you could have spent on another project or another, you know, so.
Yes. Creatives deserve, that's, you're preaching to the choir here, because creatives, that's like the essence of, you know, as my work as the numbers whisperer, so many creatives, they have all this time invested and they aren't getting paid, and they should get paid for it. They should get paid for that skill and the investment of time. I get frustrated because I see people talk about like Kickstarter and they put down all these costs for like, I got to pay the artist or this or that. And I'm like, where are you paying yourself? Right? Like the designer doesn't put in paying themselves. Like, oh, I just do it for the love. Oh my goodness. Stop. You can love it and get paid for it.
Right. Right. And I will say that I do think if somebody truly wants to put something out, and they don't care if they get, like, they just say, I need this in the world. I'm going to put this in the world and I don't need to, like, that's the payment for me. I think that's okay. But I do think that it is not always sustainable, which is, you know, if your goal is to continue to be creative over the long term, it's not always sustainable. You know, for sure, if you are, let's say you're breaking, you've got a good job, you're publishing on the side for fun to put stuff out there and you're consistently breaking even. And that's how you want to spend your time. I think that's great. You know, I think it's just the understanding that that doesn't work for a lot of people. And there's a lot of privilege involved in that, right? The ability to have enough money to fund yourself, put out projects, whether it's via Kickstarter or whatever, and then not get paid. It's a lot like an unpaid internship, right? Where like, I'm wholeheartedly against. You know, I think that it's important to remember that, you know, like, that isn't necessarily sustainable, and that it's a lot of privilege to be able to do that and not have to make a bunch of money, you know? I mean, and I think that it's been really, I've heard a lot of publishers talk about that, like, where it's like, so like when they're, you know, a newer company, they'll have put out 10 games and they're barely making enough money to scrape by, you know, because it just, that's not always, you know, you don't always do that well with it. You know, and to be like, well, I finally was able to pay myself something. And, you know, and a lot of those companies don't last, even though they're trying really hard, because again, you know, it's hard to survive when you're not getting paid. I mean, even if you have a partner who's getting paid, it can still be a drain on your resources. And the last thing I was going to say was, you know, if somebody has a passion project they want to put out, and they're going to put out this passion project and they know they're not going to make much money on it or any money, but just getting it out there is important to them, I just want to reiterate, that's okay. Like, there's nothing wrong with that, at least in my mind. But again, you're probably not going to be doing that for the rest of your life, because it's just too hard to do that and keep affording to do that. That's my spiel on that.
I love, first of all, that you're so engaged with this topic and that you're so passionate about it. It's something I'm passionate about. And I have some things I agree with, some things I have some different perspectives on, which I love that we're having this open discussion, because I just want people to talk about it. Having this discussion wasn't happening 5 years ago in this industry.
Right, right.
The thing I will say about doing it because you love it and not caring about the money, and it goes back to your point about privilege, because there are lots of people who would like to see a game out in the world that will never be able to afford it on their own. Mm-hmm. And when you lower the bar, when you say, oh, we can do it for free, but in essence, you're making it that much harder for someone who doesn't have the money to create and get a game into the world. So what I would encourage people who say, I don't care if I make money or money isn't the driver, that's fine. Why don't you take what would have been your profit and put it towards a fund to help an emerging designer?
That's good. Yeah, I like that.
So
I like that
you
a lot.
Can get your passion project out. You don't have to keep the money. I'm not, no one's making you keep the money. But there are organizations and there are groups that are trying to do some great work with lifting up emerging designers, getting them access, this and that. Put money towards that. We talked about Heather Newton. Protospiel Online offers sponsorships for people who can't afford the fees to attend. Put your money there.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great point.
You know, it's not that I don't want to see those passion projects in the world. I absolutely do. I don't want it at the detriment of people who don't have a choice.
Yeah, yeah. That is a very, very solid point. That's real good. You know, and I want to speak to the devaluing part. I've talked about this on the podcast before, so I'll just do a brief summary to tell you about it. So basically, there were some designers who were putting out these little tiny RPGs, right? And they would put them out for a dollar on Kickstarter, like buck a piece, right? And they were print and play, so there was no cost to them, right? Meaning like there was no physical production cost. Yeah.
Thank
but
you. Okay.
They were doing it because they loved doing it, but somebody went to them and said, hey, listen, when you put these out for a dollar, what you're doing is you're telling the market that this is what this should cost. And for a lot of us, this can't be what it costs because we can in no way afford that for that to be what it costs. So I think you should just consider that. And they were like, you're right. And from then on, they started charging $5 for each thing, you know, I mean, which is still not much, but I mean, it's a huge increase, right? In how much they're charging. And they did that because they were like, that's a great point. We should, you know, be recognizing that. And they even put that out there. This is why we're increasing the cost. They said, this makes a lot of sense. So from every project going forward, this will be the cost instead of the other. And you were allowed to pay more. So I think I ended up paying like $5 or $6 for the dollar one that I bought because I'm like, it's, again, I'm helping fund something that's important. But the idea that when then somebody, you know, it's conversations we've had about some self-publishing stuff where I'm like, oh, I think I'm going to put this game out for this much money, like $10. And people are like, well, but why? Like, is it worth 10 or is it worth more than that? And I'm like, well, I mean, I personally think it's worth probably 15. And they're like, or maybe 13, saying they're like, why don't you charge that for it then? Like, why aren't you charging what you think it's worth? And I'm like, well, because I don't know if people will pay what it's worth because the market is set in a way that people want to make things as cheap as possible to attract more people in. And I looked at it as I'm going to print the same amount of copies of this game, no matter what, because I'm not going to need to print more than 1,000. I'm pretty confident. So why not charge 13 instead of 10 when, you know, I believe that it's worth that and know that when I do it that way, that I will make it easier to cover the costs and make it more likely to make a profit because on the back end of selling the things that I have that will help fund that profit more so than the Kickstarter likely, that is now much more doable. And it means that if I want to hold on to that money because I don't need it right away for expenses, I could just use that to have money to fund the next thing to then hopefully build more money off that, you know, that I can then use to get to a point where it's really easy to get stuff out there. And I love that idea, you know, of charging what something's worth, not feeling like you have to cut it to get people to, you know, do that, to buy it.
I'm going to, first of all, I agree 100% and I love, excuse me, that those RPG designers made a change. I love that. There's a saying I have when I talk with creatives because they say, well, it's free. You know, or it didn't cost me anything. Or it only cost me my time. And so I'm going to give you what you and everyone listening, this statement. Time is your most precious asset. You can't roll it over. You can't borrow it from the bank. You can't buy more. Everyone from the richest person in the world to the Joe Blow down the street, we get 24/7. All of us. It's the great equalizer. Time is the great equalizer. So when you say it doesn't cost anything, it actually costs the one resource you can't get more of.
Right. Right.
And it's like, that's why I agree with you. People should consider the time as part of the investment. How much time did you invest in the game? I wholeheartedly agree with that.
Right. Right. I've got some thoughts on that real quick, if that's okay. I just want to see your opinions on this. So one, while I agree it's the great equalizer, I want to just state, and I don't think you're saying this, but I want to be clear that when we say, well, we all have the same 24 hours in a day, I don't believe that, because we don't all have the same 24 hours in a day. Because if you are super wealthy, you have different ways to, you could use all 24 hours of the day to do whatever the hell you wanted because you're rich, right? If you are working three jobs and you have kids and you're struggling, those 24 hours look different for you, right? When it comes to what you can spend your time on. And I don't think that's what you were saying.
Not at all.
You were just saying that that's the resource we have. You know, and we have to spend it the ways we have to spend it. But when we say it's just time, that's different. That shouldn't be considered, right. Well, it's time, it's free. Because it's sure, it doesn't have a cost, but it is limited, right? It's a limited economy that is not going
to
grow.
It doesn't have a cost, though. Actually, go back to your point. You're making my point for me. I love what you're saying, because when I tell creatives when they're like, I don't know if I can charge that much or I shouldn't charge that much, I say, is getting someone to pay less worth having less time with your kid? Because I have a daughter. Mm-hmm. And that's like one of my top things. I don't want to have to work so much. And I'm not saying people always choose that. Okay, please. I understand.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah.
The economy's hard. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying when we choose to pursue something and not choose to pursue payment for it or a fair payment for it, we're saying what we're selling becomes more important than time with our family, because we're not demanding a fair wage or trying at least to get a fair wage for it. So I
totally agree with that. Yes.
Agree with what you're saying, and that we are trading it. We're trading our time for something. And what are we giving up? Because we only have those 24 hours. I don't want to give up those last 2 hours that to a client, let's say, mm-hmm. versus spending them with my kid, because that's more my value system is, and that's my value system. I want that time with her.
Right. So the other question I have then is, so there's been this thing in the last several years, maybe even a decade or more, where we don't get to have hobbies anymore, right? Hobbies become side hustles. You know, that's like the thing. Yep. Mm-hmm. So, which I don't, every hobby does not need to be a side hustle, right? If you like going out and bird watching and taking pictures of birds, you don't need to start selling pictures of birds unless you want to do that, right? Mm-hmm. So we're both on the same page with that. So here's my question then.
Absolutely.
If I have a hobby, right, of I love drawing art for fun, and then, you know, when I put it out there and sell it, and I say, well, all it took was time, I don't get paid for a hobby, right? The idea is with a regular old hobby is that it's to bring joy for me. So what do you see
as selling it?
Well, so that's my question. So I'm making this art because I enjoy making this art. It just so happens people also are willing to purchase said art, right? So I'm, you know, in this isn't the best example, but I guess what I'm trying to articulate is, what do you see as the difference between I have a hobby and I'm okay with doing that for free because it brings joy? There's a, you know, like, there's somebody online I see who she does a lot of amazing artwork. And sometimes she sells it because people offer to buy it or they commission her for something. But a lot of it, really, she just does it for herself, right? And she does it because that time of doing that is important to her and she enjoys it. And the fact that people will buy it sometimes is a bonus, right? So how do you, like, what's the difference between, and this isn't like a trap or something, I really want to know opinion on what's the difference between a hobby that brings joy, not needing to be paid because the time, the investment of time is joy, to now some people want to buy it and I have to make money off it, right? Do you see what I mean? Like, in my time is money then.
My first comment would be, most people I know who pursue something as a hobby don't even try to sell it. So that's why I said, why are they trying to sell it? Because, you know, and I have friends that are artists that don't sell their art. they are not interested in being a professional artist. Sometimes what they do, which hurts my heart, but I get why,
is
they
create art
and then they just destroy it, because the act of creating it is what they needed.
Right.
They will create it, maybe take a picture and destroy it. That's art for themselves. If someone, let's say, putting it in the game world, wants to create a game, maybe they stick it out on GameCrafter or whatever, and all they're doing is charging for the components. In reality, that's not hurting the market, because
it's still expensive.
it's not devalued. I mean, and I love the GameCrafter. Don't get me wrong. I use the GameCrafter. I love the GameCrafter, but that's not going to compete with a long run production, right?
Right.
Of 1,000 units or whatever. So, and I know people who do that or get a small quantity and then go sell it at a con, and really it's just to cover their expenses. But those prices, if you were to sell it to produce at a larger quantity, would be equal. So they're not actually driving down the market.
Right.
For serious, like, quote, people who want to make it more. But if it's a hobby, what I've experienced, at least, is most people where it's genuinely a hobby, they give it away to friends, which, when it's a gift to someone, that's different. There's value to a gift. I've had artist friends gift me art, but that's like you buy your friend's gift. So, I mean, it's
right.
That's different. When it's a stranger, I come back to, well, you know, how did they get to that point? So this example you're saying, my comment would be, if you don't care if you sell it, right? If you're not creating it to sell and someone happens to offer to buy it, market at market price, because then you're being fair to all the other artists out there.
Yeah.
You don't have to sell it to live. Whereas a working artist or creative has to sell whatever they're making to live. So I don't view it as a trap. I think it's very valid. And in fact, I ask people, like whenever I play test, I always say one of the things that comes up is, what's your goal with this game? Is it just for you and your friends to play? Which is great. Hey, you know, there are games I've bought that were just made for a group of friends.
I own
that are on my shelf that I don't know if more than 20 people will ever own it. And that was always okay. But I still paid for it. I don't know if that's a completely clean answer, but that's my perspective.
That makes sense. And that, you know, when you're saying the market value is important because of everyone else, that is a good point. I think what I struggle with the most is just this whole, like, and I feel this like in my soul, like that, you know, your hobbies can't just be hobbies anymore. They have to be a way to make some money, right? Like that is... And it's always happened that my hobbies happen to, you know, correlate with things that could make some money, not because that's why I was drawn to it, because those are the things I was passionate about. And, and yes, they can also help make money. So, I mean, not all my hobbies make money. Some of them cost money and don't do anything. I think that makes sense. I truly believe
like what you're saying, and that's why when we going back to Creatopia, it was just to encourage people to be creative for themselves. I think in today's world, especially in the U.S., we're both in the U.S., everything tends to come back to business and not valuing something simply for the act of creating. And the act of creating should be valued, and it's a gift to ourselves. We're better people. We're happier people. We're more productive when we get to work, whatever work may be, if we have that creative time for ourselves. So I think in your case, what I would suggest is giving yourself permission that it's okay. So it's I get the guilt. I mean, moms are great at guilt. You know, I'm great at the mom guilt. So I get the guilt. However, it's okay to just say, I love doing this and I'm not going to make money at it. And if it fits in my budget, I do spend money on it, not crazy amounts, and be clear. You know, and so if game design for you is just a hobby, that's fine. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing at all. I'm simply saying if you're going to then sell your game on the public market, like proactively sell it, don't undermine people who are trying to make it profession.
I 100% wholeheartedly agree with that. Yes, because, again, it comes back to, what are you doing that affects everyone else in a positive or negative way?
Yes.
Or in, you know, just a flat, no change way, which is also fine. But yeah. totally on board with that.
Yeah, and in all seriousness, Jason, I think you need to cut yourself some slack and just enjoy some of your hobbies.
Right,
I mean,
right,
really.
Right. Well, you know, so game design is this really interesting hobby where everyone that does it can have different, you know, we've talked a lot about this, that all the different goals you can have with game design, right? Mm-hmm. And like, for me, it's always been, I want to put stuff out there, right? I want to get stuff in front of people. And the easiest way to do that is to, well, I mean, the most cost-effective way to do that with the least amount of logistical work is to get publishers to buy it.
Right.
Because that way you you do the design, you give it to them, and then they take it from there, right? And, you know, and I've gotten really good about, like, not doing additional unpaid work. Because I get that, you know, as of right now, the way our system works, all of the design work you do is unpaid until you get a contract and then hopefully make some money off it, right? It's all on spec, which is, you know, it was one of the things about, like, the, when you heard about the writer's strike, you know, in yeah. all of their complaints, like, they were telling the stories that this is how this works. And I might go right. several years without ever getting paid and do all this work and never get paid, which I'm not making fun of. That is absolutely right and not okay. But I was like, this is literally the same thing game designers go through. It 100% the exact same thing mm-hmm. we go through, except for y'all have the ability to get healthcare with your job if you do it enough, which is hard to do. You know, so yeah, there are so many similarities into how mm-hmm. they get screwed over, as do we. But, you know, I think one of the things I really struggle with, and I'm sure you're supportive of this, is the amount of unpaid labor that goes into the game market, right? Like, the hobby game market
oh,
is
absolutely.
Just literally probably hundreds of millions of dollars of unpaid labor consistently. And most of that is on the side of designers, right? So, like, that's why, like, when, you know, publishers used to say, do you want to help develop this? And I'm, oh, yeah. And now I say, no, I'm good. Like, unless you want to hire me, and I still am really not that interested. Like, they'd have to pay me really well to want to do that because I don't like developing games. But, like, it's just not.
What do you mean when you say you don't like developing games?
I like designing games.
What do you mean by that? So explain to me what you mean by the difference in those two, because I'm
yeah,
really curious.
So you design a game. It's looking good, right? It's playing. It's fun. It's, we'll say it's 95% of the way there, right? And that extra 5% where you really sit down, you do a ton of play tests, you do a ton of balancing, you really, really dive in to get that extra 5% done. And that's generally, the publisher does that. You know, when you sign a game and you publish it, that's where the publisher takes over and does that last 5% or 10% or whatever it ends up being, right? And so that is seen as a different process than it is with than the actual designing process. There are some similarities, but there are some technical differences to where I would argue that a lot of designers are not good developers. And there are quite a few developers who would not be great designers because your brain works differently when you do those two things, right? Yeah. So it's kind of become my policy that I don't want to do that development unless I'm going to be hired to do it, because I've already done a lot of unpaid work, and why offer to do more for the publisher when they are the ones that have now taken on the risk and the resource of financial, right? That becomes not your problem, frankly, when you get to that point, and it shouldn't have to be.
So if you self-publish, do you pay someone else to develop your game?
Depends on the game.
And I'm just trying
yeah.
to understand.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You're the first person I've heard make this distinction, and it may be more common than I realize.
It's, yeah, so it's super duper common. But
like,
in the realm you're in, I can totally see why it's not common. So here's the thing. With most of the stuff I've looked to self-publish have been RPG-style things, in
okay.
which case I can develop those on my own. They're a lot different, right? Mm-hmm. When you're talking about a card game, it's about balancing. It's about those 1% of things that happen right that come from repeated plays. I'm not saying it's easier to design a role-playing game because it has all of its challenges, but I think it's easier to develop a role-playing game to the final point only because I think you can do that with It's a different kind of work, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. They're both hard, but, you know, one involves playing the game so many times, and the other involves getting the game in front of quite a few different people and then getting that feedback and really tweaking the things. I think it's because role-playing game systems are a lot more open to interpretation, and you can play them, you know, kind of how you want within the rules.
Your GM can make it work if they need
to. Yes. And even in a non-GM game, you still can make choices beyond what you would make in a normal role-playing game where that's not as easy. I mean, in a normal board game or a card game where that's not as easy. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if I was going to do my own, board game or card game self-published, yes, I would probably bring someone on to help finalize the development for me, for sure. Yeah. And a lot of publishers now employ developers in-house who just work with them when they have projects.
So I guess because I go to a lot of protospiels, mm-hmm. and, you know, I'm used to seeing people, designers, working on the balance of their game, doing, like, the blind play testing and doing the, you know, I know people done, like, they literally could hand that off to a game publisher and all it needs is the art, right? I mean, the art and the theme and all of that.
Well, yes, but that is a matter of opinion, right? Like, one of the reasons why I don't try to make my game be at, like, 100% when I sell to a publisher is because most publishers don't see the same 100% mark as you do. Right.
I see what you're saying. Yep.
So they're going to tweak it anyways. Right. Mm-hmm. And yes, I'm all for balancing the game and stuff like that. But unguided playtests, like you mentioned, I generally for those will only do unguided playtests if I'm self-publishing because
really,
and there are other designers with different opinions on this. I think it's important to do some like semi-guided playtests if you're going to be giving it to a publisher, right? And hoping that they figure it out, right? Because obviously that's not the first unguided playtest you want to have is when the publisher's trying it and they're like, this is a mess. I don't understand this. But in my opinion, that is where the publisher should take over and they should handle all of that. And that's changed over the years. There were times when I didn't feel that way, but to me now it's about the time investment and the money investment and not wanting to do all of that unpaid work, right? And wanting the publisher to just take that on. And that has become, I've heard a lot more people saying that nowadays than they used to, for sure.
I mean, that makes sense to me. I guess mm-hmm. then I get to the point of saying, where else, and part of this is me looking at, I think the market is due for a shift somehow,
mm-hmm.
because I think that the current mechanics of the market, if you will, and uh-huh. the current rules of play in the market working so well for everyone, right? I'm a member of your Discord community, and I've been mm-hmm. looking mm-hmm. at talking about different pieces of, like, I come back to this binary self-publish or publisher,
right?
And why are there not more options in between, and you can hire people. But it seems to me that there's, and I don't know for sure what the answer is, but it seems to me that there's, you know, a lot of people talk about, I don't like the marketing and distribution side, or I don't like the operation side. You know, are there places where those can be handed off? Or is it always, do you feel like it's always just going to be that I'm doing it myself or someone else is doing it?
Can you say that one more time? I want to make sure I fully understood.
Yep. So I'm getting at, you know, I'm going to use you as an example. Let's say you have a board game XYZ.
Mm-hmm.
No, there's not a board game XYZ. Let's say you have that.
Okay.
And it's not an RPG. It's a board game or a mm-hmm. card game or something mm-hmm. like that. And you've got it to the point where it's been fully designed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you may pay someone the other 5% to do the mm-hmm. the developing piece.
Yep.
Now you're at a point where you have, and you've got your art. Okay, so you've got your art, and it's fully developed. This is just an example.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel there are options other than just continuing on your own at that point? Or, you know, what are the options to game designers that are available other than this two extremes, which I feel are rather limiting?
Well, I mean, I struggle to see... So I think within self-publishing, there's a myriad of options. And we've actually done episodes about this where we've talked about all the different ways you could put your game out there, right? But they're all under the self-publishing side, right? Now, some of those, I would say, are a bit less risky when you talk about things like Game Crafter and stuff like that, right? Where you can put it out there, order a copy, make sure the copy's good, and then you can put it out for sale, right? Yep. But, you know, there still is that pretty strong binary of you're going to self-publish in some manner, or you're going to call a publisher and have them take it over. And if I've done all of that work, hired a developer and all that, I'm going to be really hard-pressed to want to take it to a publisher, because I'm not going to get any of that money back. You know, they're not going to reimburse me for costs. If I'm lucky, then maybe they will, if I'm lucky, then, you know, maybe they will, trying to think, they would, you know, I'd make enough money off the game to cover those costs, but I bet they still do more development on it because, again, you know, games are so incredibly subjective, right? That it feels like publishers always want to put their own mark on the game or their own twist on the game, or their own style, even if it's just a little bit of an imprint, right? They want to do something to it. But I struggle to see something beyond the binary. I would love to be corrected on that by opinions that I'm wrong, like always happy to be wrong. But yeah. So that's why I see. I only see that binary for the most part.
What would you think would be? So I'm playing with this now. I have a good friend that coaches, and she likes to say, "Let's play with this for a minute." Doesn't mean it has to go anywhere, but let's play with this, which is perfect because we're talking about board game design.
Right.
So let's play with that for a minute. And what would be a high enough percentage for you of, let's say, MSRP? Okay, because MSRP is less subjective than wholesale, because wholesale can really vary. But MSRP is what it is, right? Agreed. So what would be it, that would be my advice to people when they get, because, you know, it's easier to track that. Not what it's sold at, but what is the MSRP of a unit?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know it's set forever.
Well, and you've got actually a lot of people now pushing for MSRP of the print run. So it's not of what's sold. It's I want a percentage off the MSRP of the print run. More people have been pushing for that. It's certainly a hard sell with a lot of publishers.
I don't see that happening, but I mean, you know.
We've seen a few people have success with it, but it is very difficult to say, like, I get a percentage of everything printed.
Can I say who's done, can you say who a publisher
I can't. Or you can't no, say? Okay. But I know that is something that some publishers are willing to give you, not based on sales, but so basically you get a smaller percentage, but it's guaranteed on the print run to get that percentage, right?
Okay. So they're willing to accept an upfront lower percentage is what you're saying.
To get likely. So basically, if the game bombs, they print 5,000 copies and the game bombs, I got paid for 5,000 copies, right? If I get paid an extra percent or two, but only 2,000 sell, I made out really well on the smaller percentage off 5,000.
So those rights, because I'm big into IP. So I actually have two questions. So let's go back to my first question and we'll come to IP.
Sure.
Because I have a very dear friend who's an IP attorney, and I work with her on things. She did my trademarks and stuff. And going back, though, what would be a high enough percentage to you, not to anybody, but to you off MSRP? We're setting all the other things aside for next, so I'm going to get back.
Yep.
Of an MSRP. To do all the work, if the game designer was willing, the game publisher was willing to say, or let's call them the advertising and distributor, let's just say that, right? Production, advertising, and distributing. If you handed them a game and said it's done, and they agreed it's done, let's just again play with
it. Yeah, it's done.
We're going to market it. We're going to produce it. What would be a high enough percentage for you to be willing to do that? That you would feel like you would get the money back. Because I'm saying that if for some companies, maybe it's worth it to pay the higher percentage to have something they can literally do a turnkey and say, okay, great, it's gone. We're selling it. We're doing whatever. And you may not have an answer, but I'm putting it out there as, well, what would that have to look like for it to be worthwhile?
Yeah. It would have to be It would have to be high. I mean, you figure that, I don't know all the numbers, but I mean, I think the average a designer might see on the better end is around 5%. But that's MSRP, that's off wholesale though, usually.
Oh, wholesale. So 10% yeah. MS, that would be 10% of MS.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I mean, is not, that's not super common. I mean, I've seen people get to 8 to 10% of wholesale, but I've never seen that on MSRP. But I mean, I also don't see every contract, right? So I'm sure those are out there by people. So gosh, for me, like if I was approaching a publisher who said, listen, we're going to print this for you, we're going to distribute it and market it. But you have to do everything. You have to organize everything up until then. Right. Are they paying for everything? Like, are they paying for all the stuff or am I paying for all the stuff? Like art and stuff like that.
Art.
Yeah.
Or art. No, I'm saying if you did, well, that gets back to it. Art's a big investment. So I guess it would be with or without art.
Right. Right. I mean, if I've, let's say that I hired an artist, right? So I've got the art and everything. And I've done all of that legwork, and all they're going to do is market it, publish, like print it, and distribute it. Mm-hmm. Gosh.
I mean, I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No. I mean, just on the spot, like I would have to say it'd have to be around 20% MSRP before I would want to. But part of that is me of not just wanting to put all that time and work in to do the things I don't actually want to do, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, because there's just so many things in there. There's layout. There's, you know, so if
I'm well aware of what's in there.
So, I mean, honestly thinking about that, if I've literally paid for all of that, mm-hmm. really all they're doing for me, they're going to market and it would probably have to be way higher than 20%, really.
Okay, I do have to take exception to all in the sense that someone has to fund the run. If you're going to do a run.
Yeah,
if it were just, quote, all, then every game that, you know, I would disagree with the only at that point.
No. I'm with you on that. I understand that's a bad term to use with stuff like that. But like,
I'm not arguing your percentage. I'm just simply saying that there is a major capital investment a publisher has to make, or they have to do a Kickstarter run, which is its own type of investment, to get the funds. You know, either way, they have to fund it, market it, and, you know, so on and so forth. I'm not diminishing your contribution.
I mean, I think it depends on how they fund it, right? Are they funding it via crowdfunding? Because if they're funding it via crowdfunding, their risk plummets. Right? Because at that point, you've literally invested everything and they've invested hardly anything. I mean, from a business standpoint, they've invested some time, right? Which we know is paid, but not as much money as you've paid.
Right.
So,
you've taken on the bulk of this.
Yeah.
So I mean, guess what I'm trying to get at is where's that point where too much risk has transferred back to you that it's like, forget it. I'm just going to do it myself.
At that point, it would be hard for me to, I think the only way that I would do it that way, like this is all money aside, is what is the reach of that publisher, right? If the publisher, their Kickstarter, you know, like if I have to do all that work for a little tiny publisher and this is their third game and their games have funded at say 20K or something like that. No way would I do that. If it's a big publisher that does Kickstarters that, you know, fund it well over 100K consistently and they're going to end up doing a 5,000 print run or something like that, totally worth doing all that work ahead of time. And then 20% feels fine because you're going to, you know, I think there would have to be something in the contract that states, you know, that you'd be getting your stuff back, like you'd be getting paid back, right? Mm-hmm. Quicker than, you know, those expenses. Like we cover everyone's expenses and then this is how we split the profits. And then I think I'd actually be fine with 20%, you know, post everybody being compensated back for what they had spent. So, but yeah, that's tough because I think the only way I would partner with a company like that is if they had reach. You know, I had actually, for one of my games, talked about partnering with a company, where I was going to pay for everything, but they were going, their offer was they would distribute it sell it, market it. And the only thing I had to do for them was co-brand it with their company. Right. So they get to sell it as one of their games, but I basically did all the legwork for it. And what I get from them is a presence at booths at conventions and a presence in distribution without ever having to do that. Right. Mm-hmm. And that they would promote it for me while the Kickstarter was running via their channels.
Right.
And then we just do, oh, the only thing they get out of it monetary wise is a split of what's sold, right? They get a portion of what's sold. And that, yeah. And that to me, I was like, you know what? That makes sense. We ended up not doing it that way. They actually ended up being amazing and saying, hey, listen, we'll still let you print it with us. You can go to our printer and you can do it that way. You just have to cover your own costs, but you'll get a discount because we're already printing with them. Fantastic. Right. And we'll ship together too, back to the US. Fantastic. Sign me up for that. You know, and then now I'm in charge of doing everything, but I have a way to do the hardest part, which to me, the hardest part is getting it printed offshore and getting it shipped back to you. Like that is the part where you have the biggest chance of logistical nightmares of getting screwed up if you don't know what you're doing. Right. In my opinion. I mean, you're dealing with a whole other country on the other side of the world, where you may not have great language in common with them. Mm-hmm. If it's not a company that's been validated and you know that they're good, you could get screwed. And you don't have a lot of pushback when they send the game to you and it's wrong. And they're like, well, we're, you know, in China and you're way over here and you are a one print run company. Sorry, we can't help you, you know? Mm-hmm. And well, I don't think there's a lot of companies out there doing that. There's nothing stopping them from doing that to a small time publisher, right? So that's where partnering with a publisher for something like that, to me, is the most important thing to make sure that at least on your first couple of games, you know what you're doing and you know you're working with people who are going to take care of you if there's a problem, right? Which I think is why a lot of the companies in China have had stateside reps who work with people, so that you feel comfortable and that I know this person stateside who works with this company and represents them, and they're going to make sure I'm taken care of. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you work with a publisher, like I've seen different types of IP handling. So with intellectual property, because you're, in essence, when you quote get a game published, reality is you're paying your royalties on your intellectual property.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You've signed a contract to license your intellectual property with them. Mm-hmm. They're paying you a royalty on that.
Yep.
Idea, right? Mm-hmm. It's your work, your design work. With some of these other ones, like for example, if you do paid upfront on a run, right? Mm-hmm. Do you get the rights back after that run, or do they have do they retain the right to run it again as long as they pay you again?
So it depends on the contract. Typically what happens is they own it until they have not had it for sale for a certain amount of time or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So like usually they have an initial amount of time to print it, which is usually 1 to 2 years. There are certainly exceptions to that. Once it's out there, if they keep it in print and for sale, they own it for as long as they can do that. Once they don't do that, after a certain amount of time, then you generally get the rights back. But of course, because they've paid for everything, the rights back are just your IP. You get back...
Yep.
Essentially, you get back the rules of the game.
Yep, that's the only part of the game that you worked on that you can copyright. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's always interesting to me what the protections around. And yes, the rules of the game, it's fascinating to me. That's a copyrightable thing.
Mm-hmm. Title? Nope, not copyrightable. Nope. The name?
Now, you can trademark titles if you're lucky, but that's a lot of work.
Yeah, and for your typical game, it's just not worth it, you know? I mean... You know, you see like things like Catan, the game of a generation or whatever, and they copyright that kind of stuff, right? Or trademark that kind. Of course, right? It makes sense because it's so big. But, you know, when I'm putting out one small game, it's really probably not worth it. So. So, yeah. Well, this is interesting. We had a topic we were going to talk about, and we just completely ignored that and had this wonderful discussion anyways, which I really, really enjoyed talking about this. This was, the whole time I'm commenting, I feel like I'm, you know, commenting for my whole Discord because we've had so many of these conversations that I'm like trying to think through, like, what did this person say about this? And what if so? I am confident this is gonna stoke a lot of conversation in our Discord about this. So I'm glad you're there.
I'm looking forward to it. I love this topic.
Yeah, no.
I wish more people would talk about it.
Me too. Me too. And yeah, I'll have to have you back so we can talk about what we're actually talking about, which I'm not even gonna say what it was. We'll just surprise people next time. But yeah, you'll have to come back and chat about that. But I did want to give you the chance to talk about a game that you've been working on or have worked on as part of the show. So, yeah.
Well, this will be the first game I've put out through Creatopia. It's called Cupcake Craving, and it's just a fun little Mintin game, and it will be out within the next month. So you can go over to creatopia.studio, and it will be available, as well as some adorable stickers and other ancillaries that you can get with it, because stickers, people love stickers, they sell. And yeah, it's called Cupcake Craving. You need to get to the other person's bakery with flour, milk, and eggs and avoid the cupcake monsters with adorable art.
I love that. And it's going to be in a mint tin, you said?
It'll be a mint tin.
Love
yep.
it. I love that form factor of the mint tins. They're so, it's such a nice, it's just a nice presentation. Well, yeah, this has been a really, really fun and interesting discussion. And it's great to hear another perspective on this. I know we aligned on a lot of stuff, but it's great to hear. It's great. Before we go, I would love it if you want to give out all your info that you want to give out contact-wise so that people know how to get a hold of you.
Sure. Well, one thing I wanted to point out is we now have a really cool creativity block quiz people can take for free on creatopia.studio, and it helps you depending on your block, which stress, we talked about that early on, stress can be one of your creative blocks, and you take it, it's completely free, and then we email you three ways that you can get around that block that we use and was effective. So that's something we do in our community and talk about. So go check that out. I'd love any feedback people have on that. So creatopia.studio is the best place to find all that. And on Discord, since I know a lot of gamers are on Discord, I am Nicole Fendi or Nicole Tesseray, which is my publishing company, Tesseray. And in some game places, Space Java, because I love coffee and sci-fi.
I do also love both those things, especially there you coffee. Go. Well, coffee is one of my hobbies that only costs me money. So,
hook yourself up with me at any of those. I'm at Protospiel Online, also, and I'm pretty much at like about 50% of the Protospiels. I help run the one here in Minnesota.
Nice, very cool, awesome. Well, hey, listeners, I really hope you enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you have thoughts and feedback on it. You want to start a whole convo about it in the Discord. I love when that happens. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can reach out to buildinggamepodcast.com. You can also email us at buildinggamepodcast@gmail.com. And of course, you can do the thing that everybody likes to do, which is you can keep coming back every single week. But until next time, good night.
Good night.
Building the game with Jason and friends, with Jason and friends. Building the game with Jason and friends, with Jason and friends. The end of the episode, that's
when it technically ends.